When you wonder, you're learning. Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids by Greg Bear and Ryan Radowski. Foreword by Joanne Rogers. Chapter 5. It's you who have to try it, and it's you who have to fall sometimes, learning and growing. Mr. Rogers comes through the door with a leather-bound book and a legal pad. He's got that look in his eye, that look that tells us he's learning. He's launched a new project, maybe, or he's had a new idea. Whatever it is, we've seen that look before. When he brought us the player piano, when he took us along to the shoe store, and when he found his childhood ventriloquist dummy, Hischer Boop Trunk, and showed us how it works. There are so many things to learn about, he always likes to say. And today it's clear that he's learning something new. Yes, he says, I'm trying to learn the Greek language, and I have a really splendid teacher. On his legal pad, he writes a few words, first the letter A from the Greek alphabet, then a G, then a P. Pretty soon we've guessed the word meaning before he even says it out loud. Mr. Rogers may have many interests, but he's nothing if not consistent. Agape, he says, that's one word way you say love in Greek. In fact, there are so many ways of saying and expressing love in this world. He starts to sing a song about that very idea when suddenly the sound of a whistle whips through Studio A. Mr. McFeely is here, and he's brought with him Eileen McNamara, a professional singer and whistler. McNamara whistles some bird calls in a happy improvised tune, and Rogers leans in to listen, clearly in awe of her skill. Who taught you to whistle? He asks. The whistler replies that as a little girl, she'd asked her father to teach her. I was fascinated when I was little, listening to him whistle all the time, she says. I'd watch him and I'd listen and I'd try to imitate it. At first, the point of the scene seems clear. With a splendid teacher or a patient father, it won't be long before you're speaking Greek like Rogers or singing with the birds like McNamara. It almost sounds easy. And so what Rogers says next feels in many ways like a confession. That's something I've tried and tried to do, but I just never learned very well, he tells McNamara. He purses his lips to whistle, but instead there's only silence. Mr. Rogers, the TV neighbor who can play the piano, paint pictures, sing song, and make Hischer Boop Trunk talk, has done what we rarely see him do. Mr. Rogers has failed. In 1868, an obscure writer hit it big with his fourth novel, Ragged Dick. An instant bestseller, the book told of a shoe shiner whose virtues, work ethic, and sheer determination helped lift him from poverty and into the middle class. Remaining in print for 40 plus years, Horatio Alger's book tapped and perpetuated the seductive idea that all people with enough hard work can succeed in their chosen endeavors. They simply have to persist. We can't get enough of stories like Alger's. You've probably heard, for example, that before he changed our understanding of the universe, Albert Einstein flunked math. Likewise, before becoming a basketball legend, Michael Jordan claimed he was cut from his high school team. And Oprah Winfrey was fired from her first job in television, deemed unfit for the medium. Each of these icons suffered a serious setback, yet each persisted until they dominated and even defined their respective fields. What's more American than that? Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence, said Calvin Coolidge, the nation's 30th president. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are on the podium. It's an ethos that's built into everyday life. Schools are plastered with quotes from Winston Churchill. Never, ever, ever give up. And Vince Lombardi, winners never quit and quitters never win. Some have taken to measuring and even grading students' grit, a term for passion and perseverance, coined by author and psychologist Angela Duckworth. Meanwhile, stories of persistence despite the odds are grist for the media's mill. How many times have you encountered a headline like these? Beating the odds, more than 100 homeless students in New York City graduate high school. 9-year-old sells 6,000 worth of lemonade to help sick brother. Man walks 15 miles to work every day, no excuses. Stories like these are our modern day Alger novels, hearkening back to America's original promise that no matter who you are, the only thing standing between you and success is dogged determination. The only difference between the people at the top and everyone else is that the Einsteins, Jordans, and Winfreys of the world tried harder or sacrificed more or walked more miles to work. Above all, they resolved to never, ever, ever give up. It's a fundamentally American myth, and like most American myths, there's a kernel of truth to it. Perseverance is, without a doubt, an essential part of success. No one does anything great by throwing in the towel at the first or the 50th sign of trouble. Without perseverance, we wouldn't have WD-40, which takes its name from the number of attempts required to perfect the solvent's formula, or Dyson vacuum cleaners, which came on the heels of some 5,200 failed prototypes. Nor would we have life-saving antibiotics. As author Bill Bryson writes in The Body, A Guide for Occupants, scientists searched for 2 years to find a mold strong enough to produce commercial penicillin. And they might have given up had a lab assistant not brought in a cantaloupe to share with her colleague for lunch. After scraping some mold off the rind, the scientists found that it was 200 times more powerful than anything else they'd found. The fruit was eaten, Bryson writes, but the mold lived on. Every bit of penicillin made since that day is descended from that single random cantaloupe. Perseverance, in other words, certainly has its place. But there's more to success than simply sticking with it. Horatio Alger, of all people, struggled to support himself financially despite writing dozens of rags-to-riches books. Albert Einstein never flunked math. His grades were exceptional, and he was baffled by rumors that he'd been a poor student. Michael Jordan was never cut from his high school's team. He was assigned to junior varsity, as was every other sophomore except for one who happened to be 6'7". In fact, all of the icons mentioned above, only Winfrey's story hasn't been stretched. Winston Churchill never said, never, ever, ever give up. Vince Lombardi quit job after job, and Calvin Coolidge never uttered a word about persistence. The quote attributed to him and slapped on posters, greeting cards, and coffee mugs ever since predates him by half a century and doesn't mention persistence at all. Instead, in its original form, it emphasizes purpose. The distinction cuts to the heart of a modern debate about learning. While nearly everyone agrees that perseverance counts, a growing chorus of scientists, educators, parents, and others are calling for a more balanced approach to help kids succeed. Perseverance alone, they argue, doesn't necessarily predict a person's success, nor is it particularly easy to teach. Most of the programs that claim to boost it hold limited value, writes Marcus Crota, a psychologist at Iowa State University. Instead, if we want to help kids do difficult things, it helps to consider the conditions that make perseverance possible. It helps to admit that the zealous pursuit of a singular goal, memorizing facts or formulas or playing piano at Carnegie Hall, might work for some children, while a more meandering path will likely work better for others. In fact, eventual elites typically devote less time early on to the activity in which they will eventually become experts, writes David Epstein, author of Range. Instead, they go through what researchers call a sampling period. They try out lots of different things, many of which have little or nothing to do with their eventual vocation. They grow successful not because they've persevered towards an immutable goal, but because they've been given the permission and the privilege to go out and discover their purpose. Rogers himself experienced such a period. Throughout his life, he developed all these different interests, says Maxwell King. At one point, he was going to be a French teacher. Then he was going to be a diplomat. Then he was going to run some sort of institution for very young children who needed help. Then he was going to be a Presbyterian minister, which of course he did later become. And then he decided to go into television. Rogers knew that a large part of his success had come from pursuing different interests without having to worry about whether they led or whether they'd become a career. Hence the sheer variety of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. A single episode might span the letters of the Greek alphabet, several types of whistles, visits from various professionals, a meditation on wind mechanics, and much, much more. At no point are viewers pressured to take some to something. The goal is simply exposure and sampling. If viewers find themselves drawn to whistling, that's wonderful. If not, that's okay too. Even Mr. Rogers moves on to other things. He asks only that viewers try. Life is marked by failures and setbacks and slip-ups as much as by hard-won satisfactions and sudden discoveries of unexpected strength, he wrote. We need to help children understand that for us, as for them, life is made up of striving much more than attaining. That's as true now as it's ever been. Attainment matters, but it also is temporary. It's a fast-changing world. A skill that's useful today can be automated tomorrow. People can expect to switch jobs, see whole sectors disrupted, and need to develop additional skills as a result of economic shifts, notes a report by the Brookings Institute. The type of work they do at 30 likely will be substantially different from what they do at ages 40, 50, or 60. The people themselves will be substantially different too. Despite the beliefs that we get stuck in our ways as we age, the process of personal growth never actually stops, no matter how old we are. As Epstein put it, the precise person you are now is fleeting, just like all the other people you've been. That's why striving counts as much as attaining. If we design our lives around getting that dream job or achieving a certain social status, we risk unhappiness and even disaster. In 1958, a young writer named Hunter S. Thompson penned a letter to a friend who'd asked for life advice. Though Thompson was just 22 years old at the time, and still a decade away from finding his own purpose, redefining American journalism, his words proved remarkably prescient. When you were young, let us say that you wanted to be a fireman. I feel reasonably safe in saying that you no longer want to be a fireman. Why? Because your perspective has changed. It's not the fireman who has changed, but you. Every man is the sum total of his reactions to experiences. As your experiences differ and multiply, you become a different man. And hence your perspective changes. This goes on and on. Every reaction is a learning process. Every significant experience alters your perspective. So it would seem foolish, would it not, to adjust our lives to the demands of a goal we see from a different angle every day? How could we ever hope to accomplish anything other than galloping neuroses? The goal is absolutely secondary. It is the functioning towards the goal which is important. What is it then that allows a child to strive to function towards a goal or a purpose of his or her choosing? What is it that drives kids to keep growing and learning even when it's difficult? And how do they develop the trust and confidence they need to persevere, or when necessary, to take a risk and pivot? Fortunately, Fred Rogers left us some answers. Love, or the lack of it. Oh me, oh my. In the neighborhood of make-believe, H.J. Elephant III speaks his magic words, the droning incantation that precedes his vanishing act. As he explains to the children at the neighborhood school, speaking these syllables summons a rush of wind that will carry him off in an instant, only to bring him back a few moments later to the exact spot where he stands. It's a trick called boomerang magic, and sure enough, a gale kicks up in the classroom. It's a complicated, fantastical act, and H.J. Elephant has been honing his skills for weeks. A friendly puppet whose favorite color is that of his own skin, pinkish, yellowish, brownish, orange, H.J. prepares to boomerang up to the clouds when a soft-spoken pupil timidly raises her hand. It's Anna Platypus, and she'd like H.J. to stop, please. She likes it when he boomerangs back to the classroom, but it scares her when the wind comes to whisk him away. When he says, "Ooh me, ooh my, I thought I was going to blow away too," she tells the class. HJ stops what he's doing. The last thing he wants is to scare any. The wind in the classroom dissipates. HJ's lesson on boomerang magic will have to wait. But then Anna has an idea. She looks at Daniel Tiger, the classmate who sits right to her sits to her right. Maybe, she asks, could I hold Daniel's paw? The classmate to her left volunteers as well. I would like to hold Anna's hand, says Prince Tuesday. The three of them link their arms and paws, forming a windproof puppet chain to withstand the boomerang's breeze. Anna asks HJ to try his trick again. This time, with support from her friends, she's not so scared. On the contrary, she feels safe, she feels steadied, and now she feels ready to learn. There's a reason Rogers launches this five-part series dubbed Mr. Rogers Talks About Learning with Agape. The neighborhood hinged on his long-held belief that learning and love are linked, that love is at the root of everything, as he once said in an interview, all learning, all parenting, all relationships, love, or the lack of it. It's a lesson that lingers in every part of the neighborhood. In the scene above, Anna Platypus feels threatened, both physically and psychologically, by H.J. Elephant's boomerang magic. The wind seems as if it can blow her away. The speed at which H.J. vanishes feels sinister. But with the love and support of her friends, she finds the strength she needs to forge ahead. In another scene from the Learning series, Rogers plays viewers a video montage. There's a mother teaching her son to roller skate, a coach teaching a girl to play basketball, and friends teaching one another to how to pot a plant. There are so many ways of learning things, Rogers explains. And do you know what's the best way is? To have somebody you love help you. It sounds unscientific, but scientists today will largely tell you the same. Joe Bowler is a professor of mathematics education at Stanford University, where her efforts to make math more accessible to students around the world have garnered international renown. In Bowler's view, the reason so many people shy away from math isn't a lack of intelligence, it's anxiety, the very same anxiety that Anna Platypus felt in the neighborhood. Anxiety in any subject area has a negative impact on the functioning of the brain, Bowler writes in her book, Limitless Mind. Neuroscience has shown that when we're anxious or stressed or scared, several changes occur in our heads. Our working memory, the cognitive system that helps us juggle data and use it to solve problems, short circuits. Our performance takes a nosedive, and because we've done poorly, we're even more anxious the next time around. A vicious cycle commences. A pattern of harmful beliefs soon follows. And before we know it, we're giving up on math or music or science altogether. If we want kids to stick with something, experts say, we need to take a different approach at the beginning, one that reduces the stress and anxiety that we seem to insist on inflicting. How many times have children heard that half their class will fail? Or that no one ever earns an A from a particular teacher? How many times have they been rushed through assignments and tests, told that time matters more than their learning? Tactics like these might aim to convey difficulty and inspire hard work, but they also provoke anxiety, reduce psychological safety, and push promising young people away. The less a child perceives a sense of love, the less likely she is to learn. Love or the lack of it, indeed. By contrast, the neighborhood helped kids do hard things by making them feel safe and nurtured enough to be able to push themselves. Despite the widespread misbelief that he served in Vietnam, Rogers is no drill sergeant. He never tells viewers that half of them aren't good enough. He never injects unneeded stress by scolding kids for their speed or shaming them for their mistakes. The neighborhood recognized that learning happens best without the extra anxiety that's often heaped by adults. Children always knew, for example, what they were going to see and where things were, says Roberta Schomburg. He didn't just randomly move things into different places. They could really trust that things would be where they ought to be. And if something was out of order, there was a reason and a conversation about why it had been moved. For so many kids, that's very important because their lives can seem chaotic to them sometimes. We see this in action at the neighborhood school where H.J. Elephant's boomerang magic and all its chaotic wind energy overwhelmed Anna Platypus. It's a scene that, for all its whimsy, reflects real life. When learners are faced with a threat, their bodies release stress hormones. Adrenaline and cortisol makes their hearts pump faster and their muscles tense. Their bodies prepare to run, fight, or freeze. In small doses, responses like these can be good things. Stress can motivate us. It can help us rise to difficult challenges and, if necessary, escape danger. When our stress response systems are working like they're supposed to, stress hormones dissipate after the threat has passed. Our muscles and minds relax and our bodies go back to baseline. Over time, we learn to take on bigger and bigger challenges, managing healthy levels of stress along the way. But what happens when the threat keeps coming and there's no one to turn to who makes us feel safe? What happens when we can't relax and can't get back to baseline? What happens when stress is the baseline? Suppose Anna Platypus hadn't been supported that day at school, that her classmates had ignored her or even bullied her. And suppose she'd gone home to an empty house with no food and no one to ask how she's doing. Suppose her parents work multiple jobs just to keep the lights on. Suppose there's an eviction notice on the door. It's far-fetched in the neighborhood, but it's something close to reality for countless American kids. When adversity becomes the norm and daily existence is a fight to survive, the cumulative stress of it all can wreak havoc on bodies and brains. Our stress response system works overtime, blaring warnings even after an immediate threat has passed. The constant presence of stress hormones disrupts digestion, sleep, memory, and more, increasing the risk of every imaginable calamity. It's a state researchers call toxic stress, and its effect on kids can be catastrophic. Toxic stress has always been with us, but our ability to quantify its effects is relatively recent. Throughout the middle 1990s, researchers from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, collected survey responses from some 17,000 adults. How often, the survey asked, had the adults been abused physically or emotionally as children? How often had they felt loved, hated, or neglected? Had their childhood homes become dysfunctional or violent? To what degree, in other words, had they experienced toxic stress as kids? When the researchers compared the survey data to respondents' outcomes as adults, they were shocked by what they found. Nearly two-thirds of adults reported at least one adverse childhood experience, or ACE. Nearly a quarter reported three or more. The more ACEs a person reported, the higher their risk for heart disease, depression, addiction, and more. Compared to people who reported zero ACEs, adults who reported four or more were twice as likely to have had cancer and seven times more likely to struggle with alcoholism. People with six or more ACEs were 30 times more likely to have attempted suicide. Recent studies have shed even more light on ACEs. One found that people with six or more ACEs die on average nearly 20 years earlier than their peers. Another found that while ACEs affect people from every walk of life, people of color, LGBTQ populations, and people with annual incomes of less than 15,000 tend to have higher ACE counts than others. Yet another sobering link between ACEs and incarceration. Four out of five young people who've been arrested and detained in Chicago reported childhood physical abuse. Even years after their time in detention, their risk of dying young was more than quadruple that of their peers. Through no fault of children's own, toxic stress takes a devastating toll on learning and growing. Kids whose inner alarms are constantly going off, whether due to hunger, racism, a pending eviction, a loved one's lack of health care, or any other combination of traumas, can get caught in a cycle that's hard to escape. According to author Paul Tough, students don't learn to read on time because it's harder for them to concentrate on the words on the page. They don't learn the basics of number sense because they are too distracted by the emotions and anxieties overloading their nervous systems. As academic material become more complicated, they fall further behind. The more they fall behind, the worse they feel about themselves and about school. That creates more stress, which tends to feed into behavior problems, which leads to stigmatization and punishment in the classroom, which keeps their stress levels elevated, which makes it still harder to concentrate. The systems in which children find themselves are rarely designed to support them through toxic stress. In fact, young people, particularly Black students, are often punished or pushed out of their learning environments for expressing the very challenges that keep them from learning. This can lead to a child's first contact with a juvenile justice system and a damaging criminal record, a cycle known as the school-to-prison pipeline. The consequences are beyond costly. Experts call toxic stress a national public health crisis that dwarfs even the opiate epidemic. The problem is so severe and so rampant that Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, a leading researcher in the study of ACEs and the first Surgeon General of California, has called for screening every student for childhood trauma. As she envisions it, a school nurse would get a note from a physician that says, "Here is the care plan for this child's toxic stress." Instead of reacting harshly and punitively, every educator is trained in recognizing these things. Instead of suspending and expelling or saying, "What's wrong with you?" we say, "What happened to you?" Preventing and healing ACEs, experts say, would avert some 2 million cases of heart disease and 21 million cases of depression. An extra 1.5 million students would stay in school instead of dropping out, and communities would collectively save hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Of course, prevention and healing would require a shift in the country's priorities, one that marshals out resources to meet every child's needs. By ensuring that all children have access to safe, stable, nurturing relationships and environments, writes a team of researchers from the CDC, we can prevent or alleviate the effects of ACEs. Study after study has shown that nurturing relationships and environments can act as a buffer against toxic stress. In his book, How Children Succeed, Tuff cites a study in which baby rats who've been licked and groomed by their mother excelled in every regard. They were better at mazes and lived longer, healthier lives. Remarkably, it didn't matter which mother had shown them love and care. When a pup received the comforting experiences of licking and grooming as an infant, it grew up to be braver and bolder and better adjusted than a pup who hadn't, whether or not its biological mother was the one who had done the licking and grooming, writes Tuff. The implications is that every adult, whether a parent or not, has a role to play in helping children thrive. In 2019, researchers from Brigham Young University found that so-called counter ACEs could set people up for long, healthy lives, even if they'd experienced toxic stress. Among the study's small sample, participants who'd endured four or more ACEs turned out to be just as healthy as those who'd experienced none, but only if they also reported counter ACEs, such as positive relationships with neighbors and friends, attention from trusted caregivers, and predictable routines at home. A separate study published in the JAMA Pediatrics, which came to a similar conclusion. Its authors calculated a positive childhood experience score for each participant, asking how often they'd been given space to discuss their feelings when they wanted to, how often they'd felt supported by their friends, and how often a non-parent adult had taken a genuine interest in them. The higher their positive child experience score, the more they flourish as adults, even if they'd experienced ACEs. When it comes to doing difficult things, it's important to remember that plenty of kids are doing difficult things already. Many have endured far more than their share. To succeed in their chosen endeavors, they need a sense of persistence, yes, but they also need relationships that help them weather life's tempests. They need safe, affirming environments that meet their basic needs, letting them relax, learn, and be themselves in full. And they need opportunities to sample life's flavors while they search for their purpose, the thing that makes them tick, even when that thing gets tough. That's the idea behind Remake Learning Days, a family-friendly festival billed as the world's largest open house for the future of teaching and learning. First launched in Pittsburgh in 2016, the festival, comprised of hundreds of events held over several days, brings families and kids together to sample new ways of learning in comfortable, low-stake environments. In an old theater, for example, kids and families might build robotic replicas of their favorite movie characters, or they might learn how to spot invasive plants and turn them into paper. Whatever the focus, each event does what Rogers did in the neighborhood, provides opportunities for sampling in families' own neighborhoods and on their own terms, with an emphasis on discovery, community, and joy. Dori Taylor is a mother and connector who works with art and education organizations to strengthen their engagement and community building efforts. She's also the festival's producer, and the many hats she wears reflects the variety of Remake Learning Days. We have more than 200 events in Southwest Pennsylvania every year, and they're organized by lots of different themes: the arts, making, outdoor learning, science, technology, and youth voice, she says. The events take place everywhere, from museums and parks to community centers and schools, and more often than not, they blend those themes together. There's one event in particular that my family goes to every year, says Taylor. It's held at an art museum, but you spend your time outside making paint out of leaves. So it's this great mashup of art, sciences, and nature where you get a little bit of everything. Learning, says Taylor, isn't limited to the classroom or the school day. It's something that can happen in any place, at any time, in any community, and Remake Learning Days honors and uplifts that learning. Kids and families are drawn to the festival because there's no pressure. You don't have to know or have the answers. You're just learning and discovering, and you're doing that with the people you care about. Each event is designed to be fun. They have to be fun to draw families on weekends and after school, but also to give kids a glimpse of the hobbies, activities, and even potential careers that they might not encounter during the course of a typical school day. Taylor recalls one event at Shell Games, a Pittsburgh-based video game company that hosts an annual open house during Remake Learning Days. Hundreds of families showed up, she says, and they got to meet the people who make video games and even the people who make the music for video games. So if your kids are interested in technology or music or digital media, this was one more place where they could learn more about it and maybe dig deeper if that's what they decided to do. This sort of exposure is also important for parents and caregivers. When adults sit side by side with children in a robotics lab, or when they navigate a homemade video game for the first time, they walk away with a deeper understanding of what and how young people want to learn. They see up close the things that make their children light up, an insight that they can use to support their children's learning. It was during a Remake Learning Days event, said Taylor, that my kids interacted with robots for the first time. Seeing how into it they got led her and her husband to look for similar opportunities as a family. We said, wow, our kids really like this thing, so let's look for more ways we can do that thing in the community. We even bought a robot that they could tinker with at home. Research suggests that opportunities like these contribute to positive childhood experiences by bringing kids and their caregivers closer together. According to data collected by the Global Family Research Project, young people who attend Remake Learning Days with a parent or another family member are far more likely to say they love the experience than their peers who attend it alone. Although adults tend to assume that kids don't want us around, that hasn't held true at the festival. Once adults are engaged in what's happening, children have a better experience because their parents or grandparents or caregivers are there, says Taylor. To that end, the festival's organizers have worked to make Remake Learning Days more accessible, more welcoming, and more joyful every year. Many events hosts provide food and childcare, reducing families' barriers to attending. They've also deliberately clustered events in rural areas and in neighborhoods that have long been underserved. Innovation happens everywhere, and we want to lift that up and showcase it, Taylor explains. Kids and families don't need to leave their neighborhoods and drive across town to a museum or institution. Remake Learning Days happen in your community and your neighborhood. They happen in places that are close and comfortable, like the library across the street. We try to make that the case in as many neighborhoods and communities as possible. So far, it seems to be working. Remake Learning Days drew more than 90,000 families in the first few years, earning accolades from the World Economic Forum and drawing interest from India, New Zealand, Spain, and beyond. Remake Learning Days across America has since taken root in more than a dozen cities and regions from coast to coast. In Eastern Kentucky, for example, one business in particular, a sewing store, opened its doors to families during the festival. The owner set up a table and chairs, invited families in, and taught them how to make things, said Taylor. Now she does it all the time. Remake Learning Days wasn't the impetus for that. Other regions have hosted events in senior centers, giving kids and older adults the opportunity to learn from and with one another. The festival, she says, can happen in any city, any region, any country. And while organizing anything that comprises multiple days and events will take time and money, the festival's core idea is timeless and free. Here's what Remake Learning Days is, said Taylor. It's going somewhere in your community or in the community next door. It's gathering with other people from multiple generations. It's learning by doing. It's hands-on. That can look a lot of different ways, but it's always valuable. Nothing can replace that kind of learning experience. Nothing. Effort plays a part. There it goes again, Lady Aberlin shouts, dashing across the make-believe street. Now, where is that high wind coming from? She's been chasing it now for two episodes, holding a purple and orange contraption at various heights. With her wind machine, she checks for wind at King Friday's castle and along the trolley's tracks. She checks at the neighborhood museum and looks beneath a neighborhood tree. It's a slow, painstaking experience. Sometimes the machine's tiny blades pick up a breeze and spin. Sometimes it droops like a flag on a still summer day. And other times it spins and stops without any obvious cause. Lady Aberline sighs. She's worked so hard on her research, but the wind source still seems elusive. She checks her notes and checks them again. Finally, she decides to visit the neighborhood school where H.J. Elephant is getting ready to blast off. Oh me, oh my. A gust of wind whooshes through the school, lifting the blades of the wind machine. That's it, Lady Aberlin cries. That's just what I needed. Oh, thank you. I must report my data. She rushes off, ecstatic, and pretty soon we're back in Roger's living room, where he's waiting to explain what happened. Lady Aberlin, he tells us, worked and worked and finally found out where the extra wind was coming from. Sometimes it takes a lot of trying to learn something. The important thing was that she kept on trying. Indeed, nothing comes easy to the neighborhood's characters, whether in make-believe or the real world of Studio A. Lady Aberline's wind research takes time and meticulous effort. H.J. Elephant boomerang magic takes lots of practice and several stalled attempts. Even the professionals to whom we're introduced, Eileen McNamara, the Whistler, Bill Strickland, the potter, and Mary Sherrod, the spoon player, all explained to viewers the labor it took to develop their skills. No one in the neighborhood is a natural or a genius. Some might have aptitudes for one thing or another, but their worthwhile achievements always come down to effort. By showing this again and again, Rogers helps lay the foundation for children's sense of industry. The feeling that they can use their skills to do and make important things. If we see kids who don't have that sense of industry by the time they're teenagers, it's hard to get back and foster it, says Schomburg. Once children have an attitude about working and being productive, it's easier to keep it going by showing them that some things are never finished, that you have to keep working at it if you want to make it better. Of course, there are also times when a task is complete and children can take pride in work well done. It's a lesson that Rogers embodied in his own life from high school onward. As a classmate remembers in King's biography, Rogers was head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of the fine arts, poetry, and reading. At the same time, he was also sickly, shy, and frail, and a notable lack of athleticism. Traits that might not matter in adulthood, but that don't always make for a happy, confident high school student. I was scared to death of going to school, Rogers recalled. Every day I was afraid I was going to fail. But instead of withdrawing, Rogers made a concerted effort to keep trying. When he gave a school speech, his classmates laughed at his high, squeaky voice, but Rogers plowed right through it, a friend told King. When an injury sent the school's star athlete to the hospital, Rogers, at his mother's behest, went to his classmate's bedside and helped catch him up on his schoolwork. The two kids couldn't have been more different, but their friendship helped Rogers come out of his shell. More than anything, says King, it gave Rogers a sense of social acceptance, something he'd never really known, and his confidence began to blossom. By the time Rogers graduated, he was almost as much of a star as his football-playing friend, says King. He'd written for the school newspaper and become president of the student council. He'd found a door to the Ivy League in his admission to Dartmouth College. And he'd done it all thanks to two things: support and encouragement from his family and his willingness to keep trying in the face of adversity. It's the kind of story we tell ourselves we like, in the home of Horatio Alger, hard work and effort mean more than anything else. But evidence suggests that deep down we actually believe the opposite. Writing in The Atlantic, journalist Jerry Usim describes the work of Chia Yung-Tse, a psychologist and professor at the University College London. Say asked professional musicians to listen to audio clips of two pianists, one described as a natural and the other as a striver, Usim writes, despite the fact that the two pianists were really one pianist playing different sections of the same composition and in flat contradiction to the listener's stated belief that effort trumped talent, the musicians thought the natural sounded more likely to succeed than the striver and more hireable. Indeed, the notion that success is a product of fixed innate talent is more pervasive than one might think. One survey of academics from 30 different disciplines found that the more a field valued natural brilliance, the fewer women and Black people that field included. Beliefs about natural brilliance, about who has it and who doesn't, has manifested as messages inviting some people in and telling others to keep out, regardless of their actual brilliance. Those messages affect little kids in big ways, argue Andre Simpian and Sarah Jane Leslie, two researchers involved in the survey. Adults, they say, can broadcast negative messages to kids even without meaning to. Indeed, even without believing the messages themselves. Parents are more likely to Google whether their sons are geniuses than to ask the same about their daughters. Teachers, too, are more likely to perceive innate ability in boys, even though girls tend to do better in school. Kids, of course, pick up on this. In one study, Simpian Leslie and psychologist Lynn Bien told kids about a really, really smart person. They then showed the kids four pictures, two males and two females, and asked them to guess which one the story had been about. At age five, they found boys and girls were equally likely to associate intelligence with their own gender, but that changed quickly. By age six, girls had far less likely to say that the really, really smart person in the story had been a female. Likewise, when 6 and 7 year olds were shown an unfamiliar board game for really smart kids, girls showed less interest than boys did. As Joe Boyler writes, far too many of us have been conditioned to believe that we don't have the capacity to learn. Once people get this terrible idea in their heads, their learning and cognitive processes change. In Britain, for example, it's estimated that 88% of students assigned to ability-based groups will remain in those groups for the rest of their school careers. In other words, it's likely that a child placed in a low-scoring group because of poor performance on one exam will also score poorly on the next exam, and not necessarily because of the child's intelligence. Once we tell young people that they are in a lower track group, their achievement becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, Boyler writes. They lose confidence in their own abilities, and adults hold them to lower expectations. Researchers have also documented a different but related phenomenon called stereotype threat. In a series of experiments, psychologist Claude Steele and his colleagues told Black college students who had long been aware that others saw them less adept at standardized tests that a difficult exam was a test of their ability. As Steele and his colleagues expected, Black students performed dramatically less well than their white counterparts, even though we have statistically matched the two groups in ability level, he writes. However, when the researchers presented the same test as a study of how certain problems get solved, as opposed to a measure of students' intelligence, both groups did equally well. Steele concluded that performance suffers when students feel they'll be judged on the basis of stereotypes. These findings have been replicated among other groups too. In some cases, simply checking a box to indicate one's gender or adding more males to a classroom can depress women's math scores, an effect that disappears when no stereotype is evoked. In another study, women were asked to take a notoriously difficult math ability test, writes Britt Andrews-Prada and Wired to Connect. Participants were randomly assigned to one of the three groups labeled as women, residents of the Northeast, or students in an elite private college. The third group, elite college, consistently performed the best on the exam, even though all labels were true of all women. Steele and his colleagues found that they could even induce stereotype threat among groups that don't typically experience it. In one study, they gave a group of white males a difficult math test, noting that Asians generally outperform whites. Sure enough, the group did worse than white students who had taken the test without such a caveat. All of this can contribute to what scientists call a fixed mindset, the idea that some people can't learn and won't grow, and that they'll never be able to do what their supposedly more brilliant peers seem to accomplish with ease. Through no fault of their own, kids can come to believe that their traits and intelligence are preordained. When they succeed, it's because they've been given the gift. When they fail, it's a reflection of them. They fail because they are failures. People with fixed mindsets understandably see little point in doing difficult things, in learning to whistle or write the Greek alphabet or discern the sources of the wind. Why bother with anything if you haven't been given the talent? Growing the garden of the mind. Eileen McNamara stands in Roger's front yard, whistling an improvised tune and mimicking various bird calls. At first, she tells Rogers the skill seems almost impossible. She hadn't been a natural. As a little girl, she'd heard her father whistling and decided to learn for herself. But whistling is more than a matter of pursing one's lips and blowing a gale through the mouth. It takes muscles moving in synchrony. It takes a tongue placed just so. Whistling well takes hours and hours of practice, sometimes even more. It's a skill so difficult to perfect, in fact, that some people decide they simply can't do it. McNamara was almost one of them. I started at first and it just didn't come out right, she says. But you know, if you continue to try over and over again, eventually you might get a small sound that's very simple, and then it can become fancier. This, scientist says, is the fixed mindset's opposite. Rather than believing that skills and success stem solely from mysterious innate gifts, the growth mindset holds that our abilities improve with effort. It argues that the world's greatest geniuses and great whistlers are made, not born. And it means, as the educational researcher Benjamin Bloom once put it, that what any person in the world can learn, almost all persons can learn if provided with the appropriate prior and current conditions of learning. Perhaps no one on earth knows more about this than Carol Dweck, a psychologist and professor at Stanford University, who has spent her career exploring the growth mindset's power. The growth mindset is based on the belief that your basic qualities are things you can cultivate through your efforts, your strategies, and help from others, she writes in her book, Mindset: The New Psychology of Success. Although people may differ in every way, in their initial talents and aptitudes, interests, or temperaments, everyone can change and grow through application and experience. On one hand, this can be daunting because the growth mindset removes the crutch that so many of us depend on. If great whistlers are made, not born, then we non-whistlers can't fault our genetics or some other innate barrier. Perhaps we've never had a patient-loving teacher like McNamara did, or perhaps we never put in the effort that's required to develop a skill. Regardless, our potential as whistlers has been left unexplored and unfulfilled, and that can be a difficult fact to face. On the other hand, the growth mindset can set us free. If great whistlers are made, not born, then almost any of us can learn how to whistle if that's what we choose to do. We don't have to be ashamed when we try and we fail. We fail not because we're failures, but because we're not experts yet. We're all on a journey of learning and growing and striving, whether in whistling or science or art. This is a mindset that allows people to thrive during some of the most challenging times in their lives, writes Dweck. In a study of struggling college students, Dweck and her colleagues compared the coping mechanisms of students with fixed mindsets versus those with growth mindsets. Both groups were stressed out, overwhelmed by schoolwork, and worn down by winter weather, she writes. And here we saw something really amazing. The more depressed people with the growth mindset fell short of severe depression, the more they took action to confront their problems, the more they made sure that they kept up with their schoolwork, and the more they kept up with their lives. The worse they felt, the more determined they became. We should note here that adopting a growth mindset only lets us improve from where we are. It does not mean that we can all be the next Michael Jordan or the next Albert Einstein. Perhaps we'll never whistle quite as well as Eileen McNamara, but that's okay. We all need to accept some of our imperfections, especially the ones that don't really harm our lives or the lives of others, writes Dweck. That's why Rogers doesn't spend the learning episodes desperately trying to whistle. Although he did attempt to learn, he's since moved on to things he cares about more. Pivots like these are sometimes necessary, and the growth mindset can make them easier. We move on with the knowledge that we can grow and improve in whatever we tackle next. Under the right conditions, the growth mindset has been found to increase GPAs and even mitigate the damage done by negative beliefs about learning. Remember when researchers showed children the board game for really smart kids? And fewer girls felt like playing? Well, when researchers described the exact same game as being for kids who try really hard, girls were every bit as interested as boys. The good news is that growth mindset can be quickly, easily, and cheaply taught. David Yeager, a psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin, has teamed up with Dweck Bowler and others to develop a free program available at pertz.net that teaches kids that their intelligence is malleable. A 2019 evaluation in Nature, one that includes some 12,000 ninth graders across the country, found that the program boosted grades, increased enrollment in advanced math classes, and reduced the number of students earning D's or F's in core courses. Though the effects were small in some cases, in others, they were significant and long-lasting, all thanks to an online program that could be completed in less than an hour. There is, however, a catch, cautions Yeager. It turns out students don't find the growth mindset to be valid or actionable until the teacher's behavior makes it true. A survey of the schools involved found that when teachers had fixed mindsets, their students didn't benefit. The program only worked in supportive, caring environments where adults had growth mindsets too. Kids learn and grow, it turns out, when the adults around them believe that they're able, and when adults convey that belief in ways that kids understand and trust. In his study of stereotype threats, Claude Steele and his colleagues gave students an essay assignment. Write about your favorite teachers. They asked students to include a picture of themselves, thereby making it clear that the essay graders would know the student's race. White students, the researchers found, took the feedback they received at face value. In a predominantly white institution, they saw little reason not to trust it. But black students were left to wonder whether their feedback was rooted in stereotypes. It was only when the essay graders explicitly communicated their high standards and their beliefs that students could meet those standards, that students saw their feedback as trustworthy and unbiased. In fact, when this happened, Black students became even more likely than other groups to revise their essays, even though they weren't being graded for credit. The bottom line is that when it comes to growth mindset, adults' behavior matters. It's adults, after all, who create the environments in which young people learn, environments that communicate love and respect on one end of the spectrum, or prejudice and low expectations on the other. It's adults whose job it is to build trust. If we want kids to persevere, we have to show them that we not only believe in them, but that we also are here to support them, even if they stumble and fall. The importance of making mistakes. How we deal with the big disappointments in life, Rogers wrote, depends a great deal on how the people who loved us help us deal with smaller disappointments when we were little. As any parent knows, those disappointments can be legion. There's so much to learn when we're little. In the span of a few years, we walk, talk, tie our shoes, take baths, use a toilet, start school, and more. Almost everything we do involves intricate processes and unspoken rules. Almost everything involves lots and lots of mistakes. Mistakes, after all, are the things that power our learning. In fact, at the biological level, that's what learning is, a series of new neural pathways born of silent and sometimes not so silent struggle. Making mistakes and then correcting them is how we grow our brains and make new connections. Very young children seem to get this. They struggle to walk for weeks or months, getting up, falling down, and trying again on phase. They're relentless to the point of recklessness, sometimes to their own delight and their parents' dismay. They're simply doing what they're designed to do, explore the world's surprises with wonder and joy, mistakes and bruises and scrapes be damned. But as children get older, learning tends to lose some of its luster. Mistakes become hazards, struggles become wellsprings of disappointment. As kids develop self-consciousness and start comparing themselves to others, they often become less willing to take on difficult challenges. It's not that they're afraid of difficulty, they've been doing difficult things from the moment they entered the world. Instead, writes Dweck, they become afraid of not being smart. It's easy to understand why. We live in a world that rewards the good report card, but not the work required to earn it. We praise the first place finisher, but not the practice it took to win. We want our kids to be smart, but often we punish or penalize the very things that make them smart, their setbacks, struggles, and mistakes. Imagine a fourth grader trying to learn long division. He has a test coming up, and so far it's not going very well. He struggles with the steps and forgets what to do with remainders. Homework is a nightly battle of frayed nerves and fresh tears. When division doesn't come easily, he starts to hear the message, "Your sister got this right away. Why can't you?" Or, "What's so hard about four simple steps?" Or even, "Math just isn't your thing." Of course, none of these messages tell our fourth grader that mistakes are a sign of learning. On the contrary, they suggest that if he has to struggle, then perhaps he lacks innate talent. Perhaps he's not smart. Kids who hear such messages do what anyone would do. They protect themselves. They lash out, shut down, and stop trying. They sometimes turn to bullying or other acts of cruelty in an attempt at self-defense. If they don't make an effort, they reason, then they won't make mistakes. And if they don't make mistakes, they won't be judged as not smart. Unfortunately, they won't learn either, and the cycle that follows is brutal. The good news is that parents and teachers can break it by making it clear that struggles and mistakes can be good, that setbacks ought to be investigated and put to maximum use. Stephen Chu, a psychologist at Stanford University, demonstrates this by giving his students some two dozen words on a sheet of paper. He asks one group to count the number of times that specific letters appear on the sheet. Meanwhile, he asks the other group to evaluate the pleasantness of the words. Students in the later group endure some extra struggle. Their task is trickier, more subjective, and more cognitively demanding than simply counting letters. But on tests of recall, they reliably outperform the first group, remembering up to 40% more words. The efforts of struggle on learning have been well documented. Being forced to generate answers improves subsequent learning, even if the generated answer is wrong, writes De David Epstein in Range. It can even help to be wildly wrong. The more confident a learner is of their wrong answer, the better the information sticks when they subsequently learn the right answer. Tolerating big mistakes can create the best learning opportunities. It can also create learners who are more willing to stick with difficult challenges. When kids see mistakes and struggles as markers on the path towards mastery, learning becomes more exciting than scary. Setbacks become more intriguing than disappointment. Of course, even kids who like to struggle will find themselves still frustrated. Making and accepting mistakes is one thing. Learning from them is something else entirely. For that, kids need loving adults who will talk to them honestly about their shortcomings and failures and who will help them determine what it will take to succeed. It can be really helpful when you talk about your own mistakes openly, explains Hedda Sharapan. For example, when you've accidentally spilled something like the glitter or forgotten something that you promised a child, like a turn at the easel the next day, let the children know what you've learned from your mistakes, that you need to check to make sure the lid is tight or the on the glitter jar, or that next time you'll write yourself a note so you don't forget. Likewise, it's important to value the process and the outcome and to show kids that they're inextricably linked. We want a child to swim. We don't just drop her in the deep end and hope for the best, nor do we give her a trophy for simply getting into the pool. Instead, we stand at her side and support her unconditionally as she tries different ways of keeping afloat. Learning from mistakes takes persistence, and one of the best ways to encourage that is to comment on how children are working on something, not just what they're making, says Sharapan. Think about how helpful it can be when you say things like, I saw that you were upset when the blocks fell over, but you waited a few minutes and then you built them up again. Or I noticed how you kept on trying. When you applaud their trying, they're more likely to keep trying the next time things go wrong. In fact, that's exactly what we see in Eileen McNamara, the professional singer and whistler. Thinking back on how she learned to whistle, she tells Rogers about how her father helped her try again and again. I asked him to keep trying to show me until I would get it, she says, and her father agreed. Had he shamed her for making mistakes or suggested that whistling wasn't for her, it's doubtful she would have bothered. But with his support, she found the strength she needed to keep trying, to keep learning and growing. Rogers captures this philosophy, and he's in You've Got to Do It, a song he debuted in 1969 and sang for the next 30 years. If you want to ride a bicycle and ride it straight and tall, you can't simply sit and look at it because it won't move at all. But it's you who have to try it, and it's you who have to fall sometimes. If you want to ride a bicycle and ride it straight and tall, if you want to read a reading book and read the real words too, you can't simply sit and ask the words to read themselves to you, but you have to ask a person who can show you one or two. If you want to read a reading book and read the real words too, it's not easy to keep trying, but it's one good way to grow. It's not easy to keep learning, but I know you that this is so. When you've tried and learned, you're bigger than you were a day ago. It's not easy to keep trying, but it's one way to grow. You've got to do it. Every little bit, you've got to do it, do it, do it, do it. And when you're through, you can know who did it, for you did it, you did it, you did it. Rogers sometimes told a story about a musician he admired deeply, Bill Eisler recalls. The musician would say, if I don't practice one day, I know. If I don't practice for 2 days, the conductor knows. If I don't practice for 3 days, the audience knows. And telling that story was Fred's way of saying, you always have to practice your craft, no matter what it is or how talented you are. If you keep that discipline, you have to continually keep it after. Breaking down barriers. With his aviator sunglasses, his headphones, and his hair tucked back into a ponytail, Eric Klock looks a lot like a jazz musician. And in fact, that's exactly what he is. After discovering the saxophone in fifth grade, Kloss immersed himself in music, sitting in with some of the greatest players in jazz before he even entered high school. By age 14, Kloss had met John Coltrane, who gave him a piece of advice. If you're a musician, don't waste any time, by which he meant practice, write, do. Kloss took this advice to heart, releasing 2 dozen albums over the course of his career, a few of which critics have called among the best in modern jazz. He toured the world and shared the stage with legends before finding his way home to Pittsburgh, where he sits now at a book-strewn table with one of his biggest, most famous fans. Glad to be with you, Eric, says Mr. Rogers. We're here, Rogers explains, so that Kloss can show us the special reading machine he uses at the library. Blind since birth, Kloss reads with the help of a humming gray contraption called the Kurzweil Personal Reader, a combination scanner, computer, speaker that converts printed text to speech. Kloss toggles the machine's different voices, Perfect Paul, Frail Frank, Whispering Wendy, and more. He puts a book on the scanner and listens as it reads the contents aloud. The machine, he says, certainly does help me, and also other blind people, read. Roger sits transfixed, leaning in with that look in his eye. You must have had some wonderful teachers in your life, he says. Boss agrees, saying that he had wonderful teachers indeed, that they too read books to him aloud, and that the stories they told eventually led him to jazz and his remarkable life in music. Appearing towards the end of the learning series, the scene with Kloss highlights an important caveat. When it comes to learning and growing, everything covered in the neighborhood, loving relationships, growth mindsets, the embracing of mistakes and struggles, can still fall short in the face of external challenges. Yes, you've got to do it, as the Roger Story song goes. You've got to ride the bicycle and read the reading book. It's you who have to try, and it's you who have to fall sometimes. But what if, in Benjamin Bloom's word, the appropriate prior and current conditions of learning haven't been met? What if, like countless American kids, the streets aren't safe for you and your bike? Or what if you're blind and you don't have an adult who can make a book accessible? Some challenges can't be solved through effort and mindset alone. Personal attitudes meet social or societal limitations. What's within bumps up against what's out. And it's not always a fair fight. As Bettina L. Love, author of We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom, puts it, there is no amount of grit that can fight off the intersections of living in poverty, being pushed out of school, facing a full world of patriarchy and racism, and suffering toxic stress. To suggest otherwise, Love contends, is disingenuous and even harmful. Remember those headlines from the beginning of the chapter? The ones about homeless students beating the odds or selling lemonade to pay for chemotherapy or walking 15 miles to work? They're headlines because they're exceptions. In these cases, to the inhumane conditions that keep kids and their families from thriving. They might make us feel glad for the people involved, but they don't ask why students are homeless, or why life-saving drugs can bankrupt a family, or why a resident of the United States would have no other option but to walk a few hours to work. They imply that society's problems are no match for an individual's bootstraps, and that kids and families who don't beat the odds or simply fail to apply themselves, a grossly unfair and easily refuted assertion. No mindset is a magic elixir that can dissolve the toxicity of structural arrangements, argues the author and activist Alfie Cohn. Until those arrangements have been changed, mindset will only get you so far. That's why a growing number of parents and educators are teaching kids not only to recognize and acknowledge the arrangements that shape their lives, but also to organize and advocate in pursuit of something better. They're helping kids leverage their inner world where perseverance and growth mindset live in pursuit of change in the outer world. A self-described artist activist, Heather Arnett, started out as a theater director. She wanted to use the theater to tell topical stories that impacted women and sparked audiences to action. With her goals clearly laid out and a hefty tuition bill to pay, the drama student at Carnegie Mellon University sought a work-study job that would relate to her major and teach her the nuts and bolts of storytelling and production. That's how she found herself in the neighborhood of make-believe, crouched behind a set piece with Rogers himself. It wasn't part of my normal job, she says, laughing. Mostly I helped with the viewer mail and eventually worked with Mr. Rogers and Hedda Sherapin on a book collection of fans' letters. I don't really know who was supposed to be there turning the pages for him that day while he worked the puppets. But for whatever reason, that person wasn't around, so they asked me to do it, and it was really a wonderful moment. While I'd interacted with him a great deal in the office, I hadn't yet glimpsed the Mr. Rogers I knew from TV. But on the production stage, underneath the museum go-round, with each of his two hands and a puppet, I saw that while Fred was doing that kind of work, he was most himself. He was his most animated, present self. The memory stuck with Arnett when she left Pittsburgh for New York, working various jobs in theater and advertising. It stuck with her when she came back to the Steel City to raise money for a local theater, and it stuck with her when she applied to run a newly created nonprofit, the Women and Girls Foundation. Established in 2002, the foundation fights for gender equity through advocacy, grant making, and programming, including GirlGov, an initiative designed to equip high school students with the tools for changing societal structures. In GirlGov's early days, Arnett explains, it was mostly about encouraging girls to think about elected office. We'd take them to Harrisburg and they'd shadow elected officials. You can't be it if you can't see it, right? But at the same time, because of their age, the girls can't run for office for 10 or 15 years. And so we started to think about how we could show them that they could make a difference today. Their first opportunity came in the form of a t-shirt. In 2005, Abercrombie and Fitch, a clothing retailer then at the peak of its popularity, released a line of shirts for young women that included slogans such as, "Who needs brains when you have these?" The shirts had been fodder for a heated discussion at GirlGov's first ever fall retreat, where girls spent the weekend getting to know one another and learning the basics of civil engagement. We were doing an exercise about grant making, our net recalls, and we had these mock projects that the girls could give their Monopoly money to. One of them was a fake protest against Abercrombie and Fitch. We'd included it because they'd been talking about it so much. There were three or four other ideas, but no one even remembers what they were because everybody put their money towards the protest. They were all saying, "Miss Heather, I know this is made up, but those t-shirts are real. So we should do something. We should really do something." The conversation turned to what it would take to plan a successful protest. The girls needed more than markers, signs, and megaphones. Where would they go? Who did they want to reach? If they needed a permit, what would it take to get one? The questions were just as important as the answers, said Arnett. We were teaching the girls the building blocks they needed, not just for this protest, but to organize any protest they might want to lead as savvy, skilled organizers later in life. By the end of the day, the girls had a plan. A few weeks later, they held a press conference announcing their girl cut of Abercrombie and Fitch. By a stroke of luck, the Today Show caught wind of it, and soon the girls were on national television. Abercrombie didn't respond until after we'd been on Today, CNN, and Fox News, and in newspaper articles and on NPR, says Arnett. Eventually, the company agreed to meet with the girls at their corporate headquarters to hear the girls' demands. In addition to telling the company to stop selling the t-shirts in question, the girls also presented designs that they'd developed on their own, t-shirts with slogans like "Your Future Boss" and "That's Madam President to You." In the end, the company agreed to pull the offensive t-shirt, says Arnett, though it rejected the girls' alternatives. Abercrombie's loss in the long run, she says, noting that similar t-shirts now sell well in other stores. The girls were, as always, leading the way, if only the men in the room had the wisdom to listen. Still, the early victory transformed the foundation's programming, and today it sets its sights higher on changing the policies that prevent women and girls from thriving. Each year, about 100 girls from across the Pittsburgh region enroll in Girls Gov, which receives twice as many applications as it can accept. The girls self-select into four committees: racial justice, health and the environment, education justice, and freedom from violence. Girl Gov then helps each committee develop a policy agenda, which includes public awareness campaigns and legislative advocacy. The girls meet with lawmakers, attend and lead protests, testify before city council, and recruit their peers for their causes. Girl Gov's Racial Justice Committee works to eliminate over-policing in schools and change the policies that push Black students into the school-to-prison pipeline. The Education Justice Committee pressures lawyers to secure funding for students' mental health counseling, and the Freedom from Violence Committee works to help immigrant families together. You talk about doing difficult things. That's what our girls do every single day, says Arnett. Public policy is a hard thing, and it can be a thankless thing. It would be easy for our health and environment committees, for example, to plant an urban garden. Planting a garden is a perfectly valuable thing to do. It helps your environment and your community. But does it really change things in the long run? Instead, the young women in Girl Gov push for systemic solutions to problems, even though such solutions are exponentially more difficult and far less certain than doing a one-off project. We might work all year on a bill and it won't get passed, she says, but Girl Gov isn't just about passing a bill. It's about girls becoming informed activists. It's about the process of working with girls from other communities, other schools, other socioeconomic classes, other races, and other religions, and coming together to change a policy. Because Girl Gov's high school students come from so many backgrounds and experiences, finding common ground and coming to a consensus can be difficult, says Arnett. The environment might mean hiking to one girl and fracking pollutants to another. To launch an effective campaign, the girls have to know and trust each other deeply. They have to establish a sense of safety. That's where the fall retreat comes in. We barely even talk about policy work during that first weekend, says Arnett. It's really about getting to know people who are different from you. It's a lot of team building and mixer type stuff. On Saturday night, the girls staged their main event, a revolutionary show and tell. At the beginning, says Arnett, only one or two people sign up to perform, but it always ends up becoming this 4-hour marathon. By the end of it, they're all on stage singing. There are girls from different communities lip syncing and dancing to Beyonce. There are girls doing really complicated and beautiful ethnic dances. They perform poetry that they've written, and a lot of it about how grateful they are to be in a place where they can feel safe to be themselves. It's this kind of community that enables difficult work. The relationships the girls form give them the confidence to keep going, whether they're meeting with corporate executives, testifying before state representatives, or co-hosting events and teach-ins with other youth-led groups in Pittsburgh. Young people have this amazing power in them and an ability to do something, even though they're young and small, she says. And to take them seriously and speak to them seriously, that's something Fred Rogers did. He took their concerns seriously, he took their dreams seriously, and that's what we do with teens and what our teens do with each other. We believe not just in what they can do later, but in what they can do today. We believe in what they can do right now. Mr. Rogers gathers the models he spread out on the table, the tiny trolley, the tiny castle, the tiny neighborhood tree. He gathers a tiny clock for a tiny Daniel Tiger. He gathers all his tiny figures, remembers all their tiny struggles, all their tiny mistakes. Don't they teach us a lot? Aren't Anna Platypus and H.J. Elephant and Lady Aberlin always learning and growing, just like we're learning and growing? Some people can do some things, some can do others, he said. I can't whistle, but I can clean up a room. Roger stands up and sets the figures on his kitchen shelf. He's got that look in his eye again, that look that tells us he's learning, that he has a particular project in mind, that he's thinking about agape. Do you ever think of the many things that you've learned to do since you were a tiny baby? He says. Whenever you see a tiny baby, do you ever think, I was like that baby one time, and now I'm not a baby anymore. I'm really growing a lot. And with that, our TV neighbor changes his shoes and smiles. He hasn't learned to whistle, but he hasn't failed either. Instead, he's made today a special day by striving, as he always does, towards his purpose, helping us discover on our own. It always gives me a good feeling when I see people growing and learning wonderful things, he says. And then the piano plays, and Mr. Rogers starts to sing. What might you do? Schedule what David Epstein calls Saturday experiments. Deliberate yet pressure-free opportunities to try something new. Remind kids they don't have to be good at this strange new thing. Talk about why it might feel strange. Talk about why it's important that they try. Sample lots of activities. Kids can develop an interest in something if they don't know anything about. Hey, let's skip this stone across the pond. Or have you ever seen a garden over in the neighborhood's yard? Or I have this glue gun on this shelf, and you have lots of empty cereal boxes. Notice what lights up a child. Every child has an interest, a fascination, or something that they want to figure out and improve. Pay attention and figure out what you can do to nurture that interest, however unfamiliar it might be to you. Approach it with enthusiasm and without judgment. I don't have a clue why my daughter is fascinated by Paris. We've never been there, and I can only say bonjour. But maybe we can figure out how to make croissants. And maybe we can start to learn French by doing online lessons together. And maybe we can go to the museum and see those impressionist paintings. Be by your child's side, not just as the game or at the recital or the moment. If you can, be there at the practice too. Be there to talk about how hard practice was or to hear about the problem she had while coding her robot. If you give your child feedback, be sure it's specific, clear, and focused on improving the task instead of changing the person. Remark how difficult it was for you to learn how to play the piano or how hard it was to start a new job. Talk about your own frustrations or mistakes and mention how you moved forward.